another edition of Homespun C-SPAN. Today we bring you the question and answer session, first part of two, from a forum recorded November 17th, 2005 at Leadership Metro Richmond entitled Deconstructing Homelessness. The forum featured Reggie Gordon, LMR graduate in 2002 and now the executive director of the William Byrd Community House, who was formerly the director of Homeward, a homeless services coordinating organization hosted at the United Way, and sorts of much controversy among some homeless and homeless advocates. Also speaking will be Greta Harris, the senior program director of LISC, which provides matching funds to nonprofits that seek to build housing for low-income people.
Imagine if Philip Morris closed, or, you know, some FFV is closing. There are people who are living on the edge, but are now paying their rent, paying their mortgage, have kids in school. But when the bottom drops out, the only safety net right now is to turn to the shelter system. I hope we're smart enough and compassionate enough to figure that out.
I've been interested in housing as long as I could build Legos as a five-year-old. So I've also done drywall finishing for 14 years, and I've also lived out of my car. I'm not sure that would qualify as homeless or not, for about a year. So I think I might have a few insights, and I'd love to hear your feedback or anyone else's. It strikes me that there's always been homeless. We didn't necessarily call them that. Jesus said there will always be the poor. You read, Dickens novels that talk about people living in the street. You look at letters from Civil War, there are people who talk about living in the street. You think about the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. There's hobo camps. There's always been homeless. What I think is different as of the 70s is that there's been a concerted effort to make poverty illegal in the United States. And what I mean by that is that we take the coping strategies of the poor and we make it illegal. So there are some neighborhoods where it's illegal to grow food in your yard. There are some neighborhoods where it's illegal to dry your clothes on a clothesline. You're not allowed to work on your car in front of the house. You're not allowed, you know, you just keep taking away the coping strategies. And so when you're on that edge that you said, we keep moving the edge up. So the level of performance, the level of economic performance required to not be off the edge, but on the edge or back, keeps going up. And that to me strikes me as the biggest problem. And I know the reason that we keep moving the edge up is because of these factors right here, is that we don't want to deal with the crazy neighbor. So what we do is we crank up the price of real estate in order to filter them out. And, I mean, you think about it, real estate is the only thing that we're happy to see a price increase on. If the price of milk goes up, it's called inflation. If the price of gas goes up, it's called a national disaster. And when the price of the house goes up, we pat ourselves on the back and say it's a housing boom. Well, there's other things that go boom, too. They're called bombs. And the problem is that we use the price of housing to filter out problem people. And so that strikes me as the core problem, is that we have a systematic effort to make poverty illegal in order to get them away from us and our children. And that's the core problem.
I don't know. Okay. I mean, that's very valid.
Well, I hate to follow that, but I actually have a question. Well, this is related. It really is related. There's a part, and this is a sincere question, a part that I don't understand. And it's going to take a second to ask it, but it won't take that long to answer it. Going back to your narrative, Reggie, when you were talking about the Great Depression and the aftermath and stuff, well, we all anecdotally know about that. None of us are old enough. But we've all seen the pictures and know what happened. And somehow there was an assimilation thereafter where the nation recovered from that. And moved on through the 30s, 40s, 50s, stuff like that. And in the 70s, maybe it was Greta that pointed out the catalyst, well, I guess starting in the 50s, of suburbanization that changed the physical landscape a lot. And that was a huge contributor to the lack of being able to reassimilate, I suppose, after, which most of us do remember, some economic difficulties of the 70s. But here's the question. I mean, I remember vividly the economy of the 70s, and I mean, it wasn't great, but it wasn't the Great Depression by any means in terms of dislocations or economic disadvantages and stuff like that. But we didn't have a reassimilation after that. And that's what I'm asking. Why is that? And is it possible one of the reasons this whole problem is so vexing and tricky is that this time around we had sensitive, well-meaning social programs that were available, that weren't available in the 20s and 30s, that to a certain extent made it possible for this to occur. I mean, what I'm trying to figure out is how could they reassimilate then? I mean, was it charities? Was it something? Was it the economy was just strong? Was it the lack of suburbs? So everybody was all in it together, much to a greater extent than they are now. Or is there something else? I mean,
I'll take a crack at that, but I'm sure.
Sorry, it's
not an easy answer, but I think it ties into everything what you just said. I mean, it's multi-layered. And maybe we have, in the nonprofit circles, there's been some discussion about have we done our jobs too well, you know, and that have we buffered our communities from the day-in-day struggles of the people that walk in our doors who can't make ends meet, who have the challenges that, that Greta has mentioned, that I've mentioned. Case in point, Greta said her people, and we have our people in homelessness. We're trying to figure out how do we merge poverty. Poverty is stratified. You know, we're too poor to be eligible for programs and all of the publications. I work with Greta. You know, every document, every publication mentions low income and helping people who are in crisis. But who would think that you're not?
I can't reach as low as your income of your population goes.
So some agencies are reaching. Why are we here? I mean, what happened? Reed has his hand up, so he must have an answer. But it's just, it is complicated. And one of the things that, before I left Homeward, we were trying to open up the doors, and many people in this room were involved in having a heart-to-heart about how do we deconstruct nonprofit work. Are there too many of us? Let's look in the mirror and decide maybe our work is done. Is it okay to say there's no longer a need for all of us to do the same thing, because maybe we need to focus, redirect our energy toward the solutions of prevention and housing?
Well, my observation would be, if we talk about after the Depression, we had incredible public works programs, and we had the GI Bill that the government was playing the war. And so there was a significant amount of general public commitment and consensus that we had a corporate collective responsibility to assure the welfare of people who had been through a significant stressor, the Depression, and the people who had made these significant contributions to the war. Really needed to deserve our public commitment for education and housing. What I would suggest to you is that not-for-profits exist and flourish because we don't see that public commitment in the same way.
And I'd add one other layer to this, though I have no proof of what I'm about to say, but I would dare say that the color and face of who was in crisis in the 30s is maybe a little different than who's in crisis today.
Yeah, would be my guess.
And even if there were blacks, my mom and dad grew up in the Depression era, but they were living on farms. So they had the opportunity to be much more self-sufficient than in an urban center. And there was also the migration from the South to the North and Midwest for job opportunities from the rural South. And so when you got there and then really, the inner cities became racially and economically segregated, and people who could move up and out didn't have to deal with that. You kept running further, well, not you, but I mean, people kept running further and further away from the issue. And honestly, a middle-aged, undereducated black male is a tough constituent base to get people to be warm and fuzzy about, to say that we need to.
It has a criminal record,
right, you know, to say that we need to do something as a society here. And it's tough. It's very tough to rally around that.
Alice?
Let me add that credit to what Greta is talking about. And actually, Greta neglected to say that Virginia Supportive Housing does serve this population, and we're the only nonprofit that does. But this is a very complicated issue, and there's no easy answers to it at all. But I do remember going back a little bit more to the history, too. I moved to here in 77 to go to school, and in, like, 79, there was a shelter here. It was called a mission shelter. And I remember when that closed, it was a place, probably the only place where, you know, if you wanted to lay your head, you could. and it was obviously very faith-based. And there are mission programs all over the United States, but this one was closing, and this was the only place in Richmond, you know, where you could stay for nothing. And it closed. So what happened is a group of us got together and started the first emergency shelter in the city and opened what was then Emergency Shelter Incorporated in 1981. And that is still existing today. I think they're now calling themselves Home Again. It was the SI Connections. And it was right at the corner of Maine and Sushi. Mm-hmm. So that was the first shelter. What happened after that, the problem even got worse because, it's very complicated, but they started closing all of these very inexpensive sort of rooming houses, like the Early Hotel and the Capitol. The Y used to have rooms upstairs. And so, you know, that happened. You know, they started deinstitutionalizing more folks. The only federal agency that was providing any money in subsidies, you know, that money declined and decreased. And so and people were moving away and weren't around their families. So, I mean, with all of those things coming together, I think there wasn't anybody that was filling that gap. Mm-hmm. And I know that's why we started Emergency Shelter. It's because, you know, we felt like there needed to be a place for people who were falling in between those cracks. I mean, what's happened in the meantime is that, you know, we've really sort of just institutionalized that system, that emergency shelter system, without really fixing the problem, you know, and coming up with the really good solutions, because it really was just supposed to be a stopgap thing. So that's what Reggie's talking about in terms of, you know, really wanting to come up with permanent solutions to the problem.
It typifies the dialogue on this whole subject that we have to try and avoid going to the extreme of saying this is so complicated we just can't do anything about it. And the other extreme is looking for very simplistic answers which make us feel good. And one of them is, we've talked about it, Reggie, we've talked about it a lot. There is a very strong belief that if you build it, they'll come. In other words, if we create a facility for homeless people here or for people with substance abuse, all we're doing is increasing the problem. That we're going to create more of a problem. My feeling is that you're right, Alice. We have not looked at the real underlying roots of this problem. There's a good book called Hooked by a doctor out in San Francisco, and he talks about interviewing people on this subject, and the people in San Francisco deal with it on a monumental level compared to what we deal with. And the person in charge of the coalition out there of homeless providers said, you cannot talk about homelessness without talking about poverty, racism, crime, employment, housing, teenage pregnancy. I mean, it is all tied. It is all linked. It's all, you know, part of the problem. And there is not one strand that you're going to pull that's going to unravel all of this. It's going to take an effort at all levels. And I think part of what you were talking about, and the difference, too, going back to the 20s and today, is that we live in such dramatically different communities. Think about it, where your grandfather grew up or where your grandparents grew up. They grew up in a neighborhood where they didn't move most of their lives. If they did, they maybe moved once. The average person moves 7 times, 8 times in their lifetime. We don't know our neighbors like we used to. The community doesn't exist. And I think that's, when you look at it, part of our problem. It's real easy if you live in the far West End to read about drug addiction and substance abuse and crime and go, gee, that's terrible. But it never affects you. It never touches you. It never really impinges on your life directly, daily, the way it does if you live in Blackwell, where a bullet might run through your house one night, you know, where you know people that have died of substance abuse, died of overdoses. You know people that have died from being shot by a drug dealer. I mean, we are so separated, it's hard. And I don't think people do. I know people care. I do believe that. One of the things you said, Greta, was people just don't care. They don't care long enough. They care for 10 minutes. I don't believe that. I believe they care. They don't know. They don't see it, and they don't feel it. And if you could somehow close that gap, I think the community would. I think they've done polls in Chicago, in Columbus, in Ohio. They did a poll, and they asked people, if we increased your, would you agree to an increase in tax if it went to help the homeless? 80% said yes. Now, there's not a politician in this country, I don't care whether you're running for city council, who would say that we need to tax, we need to increase our taxes for anything, let alone the homeless. So we are swimming upstream compared to what it was like in the 20s. In the 20s, you didn't have to, you had some support.
This is Homespun C-SPAN on WRIR. Today, you're hearing Reggie Gordon and Greta Harris taking questions at the November 17, 2005 Leadership Metro Richmond Forum called Deconstructing Homelessness. Reggie Gordon was the director of an effort called Homeward to coordinate homeless services in Richmond.
So, handing back to you, I think that's one thing that we just talked to. One of the things that I think technology has done is created a different marketing scheme. And I think that marketing scheme has changed the concept of what the American dream is. The American dream is different today than what it was in the 50s. So the American dream was to have a, you know, safe, secure family, a wonderful neighborhood. But the marketing of it have changed into more for me and more for me and more for me. And as an African American, the scenario that you described, all of a sudden, the chill can't come into the suburbs as a drug. So the marketing concept of what the American dream is has also changed the basic concept of how we took care of each other. I think there's another piece that we need to really give thought to, and that is the fact that poverty has become and have been big business. So the big business of poverty, some of the systemic challenges of that, in turn, causes us to make laws that keep poverty going. Because if poverty is removed, a lot of monies are removed that promotes that American dream as it is defined there. I look at and have worked in communities for 25 to 30 years, and I've laughed one day and be angry the next at how people can put down a person who gets $291 a month for they call them lazy. They say they get all this medical expenses free and they get food free, but the medical dollars are going to, they're not coming out of their pockets, they're going directly to other big businesses, or the food stamps is going to grocery stores. So they are basically getting 25% of what they may be getting through that system. The other 75% is going to support poverty to so many big businesses. So we also have to realize that poverty is big business. And when that is, when big business is challenged, there are always going to be roadblocks to prevent that from being overturned, and we sort of forget that.
I don't have answers. I just have questions. So if anybody here could respond. I will also say, I bet I'm the only person in this room right here who has spent a day in the city of Richmond jail. My LMR class took the whole shooting match and went down and spent a day in the drunk tank lockup up here on 10th Street. And the rest of the day, we had lunch at the city jail. And we were all locked up. We toured every bit of it. I look at this statistic of it, the majority are felons, 63% have that history. And I spent about 6 years as a volunteer with a nonprofit here in Richmond that was addressing the nonviolent juvenile offenders. So that's another whole issue. But to me, my economic, because I came from that social structure where the family did take care of each other. I think we have a different social structure. I think our culture is very, the family, the neighborhood, the community doesn't have a general caring for one another as they did when even I grew up. But here's my question. silly thing, silly me. Where is the community bank that was over here, over on Chamberlain, that was had money to loan to first-time homeowners that would move into I-Zone North Side? Does it still exist?
I don't know about a community bank, but almost, I mean, there's lots of
money out there to help people get into homeownership opportunities for first-time homebuyers. There are public sector dollars, there are philanthropic resources, there's private sector capital. We use a lot of it to do housing.
Next question, what is the role of education? I grew up on a farm in Louisa County. The only thing my daddy had was a piece of land, some cows, and a general store. I got to go to college on a four-year teacher scholarship. Okay, I look at those young black males down there in the city jail. Who was it that missed the boat in telling those young men that an education was the way out of poverty? That was, you know, my mom and dad told me that, you know, I could be a nurse, a secretary, or a school teacher. And you know, that was, those were my choices. So I chose to teach school.
Yeah, in response, I think that's why, as I mentioned earlier, what we're talking about now, the topic was deconstructing homelessness. This is, you're exactly right. This is how we deconstruct. Why are we having this dialogue? So what the response is to look at where we interface in a way that can solve that challenge, this crisis. Education definitely should be one of those variables that we need to focus on, because look at the long-term impact when Johnny can't read in the third grade, you know, there's no...
I don't think you always just throw more money to build something and they'll come. I want to say, let's give these guys down there a shot at a college degree.
I think we've articulated, though, and it goes back to T's point, we do build jails. I mean, we are saying there is an economic way to manage this population that seems to grow, and it's a dirty little way to analyze how we've responded to the breakdowns of various levels, but it employs a lot of people. There's an engine that is running because there is this constant flow of individuals who probably aren't able to reach their goals for various reasons. Maybe they didn't have the family structure to get there in the first place. Maybe the school system wasn't funded well because the families that could reach that level moved out to suburbia, which left underfunded schools. But when we're sitting at our homes, it doesn't necessarily impact us that we're responsible for the reason that guy's in jail or prison.
The other thing I would say with education, and I grew up in an environment where, my grandparents were tobacco farmers. They worked on the land and provided opportunities for their children to go to college. And that tobacco farm income also helped my cousins and siblings be able to go to college. And education does not guarantee economic success, but it certainly gives you more options. Now, back up. The same folks that you're saying, let's give them a college degree, ask them how many of them can actually read and write.
No.
And then we go back up to the educational opportunities to people who are living in impoverished areas where the educational systems are unequal because of the concentrated poverty. More than ever in our society today, we have segregated educational systems. And so when you have a homogeneous population, economic and racially segregated by choice, not by racial or by political mandate, but by choice, because people who have the opportunities to move up and out leave people who don't have choices, and then you have an unequal educational system. So until we can, certainly in rebuilding neighborhoods, and we're trying to attract higher income families to come back into areas like Blackwell and Churchill and Highland Park, people aren't just buying a house. We do a great product. You know, you can drive there. I'd be happy to showcase any of the housing that we're involved in. It's excellent quality, but people aren't just buying a structure. They're buying a community. And so either the real or perception of crime, as well as the quality of the neighborhood school system, are the biggest attractions or detractions to trying to diversify people coming into a community. And I really believe that until we have diversity and that's embraced wholeheartedly, economically, racially, ethnically, then we got a couple of different societies that are running on parallel tracks right here. And will there always be poor in our community, in our society? Absolutely. Historically, it is the way it is. But I think we are judged on our humanity as a society on how we respond to those who don't have much.
there are so many questions in my mind. You can't pull just one thread and have everything unravel. Every topic that you can think of almost helps lead to this situation, whether it's education, teen pregnancy, or all of those. But if you do look at 63% who have been either incarcerated or convicted of a felony, what is done? Is there any effort in the penal system when people are being released?
There's an opportunity to make a partnership, a connection, something needs to, some conversations need to be had.
What happens in our criminal justice system, not or very little, and that's one of the problems. Do you know when someone is released from prison, do you know how much money they're given?
No, that's why I'm asking.
It's $25, right? Isn't that it?
Yes.
They're given $25 and brought to, wherever they were committed their crime. And, some of them have a place to live, some of them don't, and that's it.
When you were talking about SROs,
mm-hmm.
did you see a pressure from any municipalities to get rid of them?
There aren't any to get rid of right now. They were boarding houses. We have two SROs in the city now, and that is one of the solutions. There is a real pressure, and not in my backyard, to do any more SROs. Because that's not a good thing. That is not seen as a good thing, where it really is. So, that's one of the solutions is to do another SRO.
Have you seen any support for the idea of letting SROs come back into existence somewhere?
No.
Well, I think right now they're currently, and SROs are single room occupancies, which is a type of housing that, where someone has a room with a twin bed and maybe a modest sink and refrigerator and shared, but kitchen and bathroom facilities and maybe a living room. But the critical piece is that they have support services that go along with it, and on a regular basis, people can come in, get themselves together, and then go back out and become integrated back into society and become contributing citizens here. And it does work. But right now, there are two facilities in the city of Richmond. The city is saying that they aren't supporting the development of any more SROs until the surrounding jurisdictions step up and take some responsibility to have them located in their jurisdictions as well. It will also say that when you look at the greater Richmond region, including the city, Henrico, and Chesterfield, 70% of the region's poverty is located in the city of Richmond. So the city of Richmond is trying to come up with strategies to economically uplift the mix of its citizenry base to be able to generate more revenues and not shoulder the lion's share of the region's more impoverished citizens. So it's a very complicated issue. So if we go to our leadership in Henrico and Chesterfield and say, we really want to make sure that the city of Richmond is a strong and vibrant and healthy, a model city across the country to attract all sorts of businesses, but in order to do that, we need to deconcentrate poverty. And by the way, that means we need to move some of our more impoverished citizens to Midlothian or to a short pump or to wherever you want to put them. We start to get a little pushback. And then we start to think about, we need a regional transportation system because the job growth is typically out in the outer ring suburbs. And if we really want to, assuming that we have a good educational system and people have the skill sets to be able to be hired, but the jobs are out in Goochland and there's no transportation to get you out to Goochland, then it becomes a little bit of a dilemma to actually get to the solution.
I know you had some other statements. What I want to reiterate is, sure, we've been doing this for a while, but everyone in this room has a piece of the puzzle, and this is a really important conversation because when we leave at 2 p.m., when you go back to your families, your places of work, your places of worship, your community meetings, neighborhood associations, we hope that we all feel a little bit more empowered to stand up if someone's about to bring an SRO into your neighborhood, to your neighborhood, and you have to say, well, let me tell you why we should help.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Homespun C-SPAN. Today we brought you the question and answer session from a forum recorded November 17, 2005 at Leadership Metro Richmond entitled Deconstructing Homelessness. The forum featured Reggie Gordon, LMR graduate in 2002, and now the executive director of the William Byrd Community House. who was also formerly the director of Homeward, a homeless services coordinating organization hosted at the United Way and source of much controversy among some homeless and homeless advocates. Also taking questions was Greta Harris, the senior program director of LISC, which provides matching funds to nonprofits that seek to build housing for lower-income people.